Next matter, Tammy Khan, appellant, Bic Graphics, or Graphic USA Manufacturing Company, Inc., respondent, A182112. And counsel, you're welcome to come forward as soon as there's space to make yourself comfortable and ready. Counsel may have heard from the previous matter, just as a review, both counsel will be opportunity to 15 minutes, up to 15 minutes, and appellant rebuttal for five, if you wish. I see two counsel for respondent. Is there one in particular who will be making argument today?
I'll be arguing.
Okay, very good. Thank you. And as soon as counsel for appellant, you're ready. And a reminder for all attorneys, if you identify yourself for the record once you do approach the podium, and keep an eye on the light on there so that when you get to yellow, if you can wrap up any comments or answers to questions, we appreciate that. And otherwise, if you're ready, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Stephen Fiebiger on behalf of the appellant Tammy Khan. At summary judgment, the court must view the evidence in the light most favorable to the non-moving party and resolve all doubts and factual inferences against the moving party. With these principles in mind, Tammy Khan asks his court to reverse the summary judgment on her claims of discrimination on account of her disability under the Minnesota Human Rights Act for wrongful discharge, failure to provide reasonable accommodation and reprisal, as well as her claims for retaliation for seeking workers' compensation benefits and refusal to offer continued employment within her physical limitations under the Minnesota Workers' Compensation Act.
Can I ask with you about your disability claim? Besides the specific factory work at issue here, the evidence shows that Ms. Khan's lifting restrictions substantially limited her ability to do what?
They, applying the language from the Minnesota Human Rights Act, they materially limited her ability to do overhead lifting and overhead repetitive functions.
Well, that's circular. You're saying that the evidence shows that her lifting restrictions prohibited her from lifting things. I'm asking you what conduct under the, according to the record that we have, what conduct was she limited from doing? What could she not do with these lifting restrictions besides the actual work at the defendant's employment?
Yes. At work in the miscellaneous assembly area, she was prohibited from working on the machines. The assembly area consisted of a number of machines. And throughout the course of her time period after she sustained her injury up until her last day on the job, she was not trained on any of the machines and not allowed to work on any of the machines, nor was she assigned to work on any of the machines.
So is your answer nothing? I mean, I'm asking you, besides the factory work on these machines, the evidence shows that her lifting restrictions substantially limited her ability to do what?
Well, I think that's where we have a dispute, Your Honor, because our client and her QRC, Lori Deacon, indicated that she could perform certain functions within the miscellaneous assembly area.
I'm aside from the assembly area.
Sure.
Aside from her job, her lifting limitations prohibited her or restricted her or limited her ability to do what? My impression from the record is there is no evidence that it limited her to from doing anything else. But if I'm asking if you can point me to evidence of the restriction limiting some other conduct.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to sound circuitous here, but we think the injury and her impairment materially limited her ability to perform the work at the machine operation.
No, I understand that. I'm just asking, was there anything else?
There was some testimony about she had trouble reaching dishes in the cupboard and doing some vacuuming, which was similar stress on her right shoulder and the repetitive nature of those types of non-work activities. She testified to that at her deposition.
That she couldn't vacuum, or that it made it difficult for her to vacuum?
My recollection is that it made it difficult for completing those kinds of household tasks.
Besides those things, reaching things in the cupboard and vacuuming, is there any other activity besides what you've already discussed that her restrictions prevented her or restricted her from doing?
No.
Mr. Fieberger, does not the facts, I'm focusing on the retaliation claim, and your argument is there's genuine issues of material facts such that summary judgment ought not to have been granted. Is there any fact other than the ending of the temporary payment, as I understand it, and that's when the discharge, but as I understand that was over 2 years after the actual incident. Are there any specific, and plus I understand it's undisputed that it was actually the company's HR that assisted her in obtaining workers' compensation. What in the record is genuine issue of material fact that would demonstrate that they were retaliating because of requesting and obtaining workers' comp versus, which I know we'll hear from respondent Saw, trying to find a job that exists within her restrictions?
I think the way her discharge unfolded supports the genuine issue of material fact on the retaliatory discharge. She reached MMI in March of 2016 when her doctor assigned her the 3% permanent partial disability rating. And at that point, BIC's HR representative, Tammy Murphy, said that they stopped any effort to provide any kind of reasonable accommodation. And the way this connects to the retaliation claim, Your Honor, is the ending of her TTD benefits in June triggered this email from Ms. Khan to other BIC officials saying, hey, look, her benefits ended June 9th, I think it was, and we need to do something. And that set in motion her discharge. And I think a reasonable jury could connect the two events as retaliation for seeking the workers' compensation benefits.
But the event has to be seeking, the correlation has to be between the plaintiffs seeking workers' compensation benefits and the adverse employment action. I think Judge Slater is right, or you can correct us on the record. It seems as if the entity that was seeking benefits was the employer. The employer sought benefits for your client on your client's behalf. Is that an accurate description of the undisputed facts?
I think the way I understand it, Your Honor, is that my client had to seek the benefits and certainly went through the proper channels through the company representatives to connect with the workers' compensation insurance carrier and get benefits paid. But my client had to seek the benefits and...
Well, your client had to participate in the process, no doubt. I mean, an employer can't do it without the employee's consent. But my understanding from the record is that the employer was the one who initiated the process and assisted your client in making sure that she had filed appropriately for workers' compensation benefits. Is that an accurate description of the undisputed facts?
I think that's right. I think initially that's how the benefits were.
So how is it that I'm having a hard time seeing how the element of causality is met on the idea that the employer terminated her for seeking benefits that the employer assisted her in seeking and tried to help her to obtain. So what is the, help me understand the causal connection that makes this a disputed issue of material fact.
Yes, the events surrounding her discharge date, she was fired on June 28th. The TTD benefits ended June 9th. That's when the email went out from Ms. Murphy indicating she was done receiving TTD benefits. They didn't fire her while she was still receiving the benefits. They waited until those had been completed.
So how does that help the argument that they terminated her because she sought workers' compensation benefits?
I think what it shows, Your Honor, is that Ms. Kahn had received benefits going back to 2014 when she first sustained the injury. And after the first 6 months, she eventually had a shoulder surgery. She's off for 6 months, recuperating, getting benefits. She came back to work, had another second surgery, then was recuperating another 6 months. And I think really what happened here is that Beck didn't want to go through that again. And her seeking the work comp benefits was the impetus for her ultimate termination. They waited until the TTD benefits were finalized after she'd reached MMI in March of 2016 in June. And then the process got rolling for her termination. So it's a combination of the history of her receiving the workers' compensation benefits, the issues on the job trying to find other suitable work that she could perform within her permanent restrictions. And eventually they just decided that they weren't going to keep her.
What is the job that the evidence shows that your client could have performed within her restrictions on a full-time basis?
The job that she was working full-time the day she was fired, she was assigned to work on the tables where it's repetitive work. Basically, all of the work, as I understand it, is repetitive in some manner, stuffing envelopes, sorting calendars, applying these little Mylar flags, things of that nature. And so she was doing that full-time. She'd increased her hours from 4 hours a day to 8 hours a day. She was working with her QRC, Lori Deacon, to see if there was any other accommodations to continue gradually working into the machine assembly operator positions or functions working on the machines. But those were rebuffed by Beck in that, and we've listed these in our brief, as far as the many, many efforts by Lori Deacon to reach out to Beck to try to accommodate her so she could work more functions in
That's
the miscellaneous assembly position.
Why would she need an accommodation if she could perform the job that she was in that she was performing within the restrictions that her physician had indicated applied to her?
And that's a fact question we have, Your Honor, because she was working with no problems full-time as of the day she was fired, and Beck gave the QRC no indication that there were any problems as far as they led her to believe that everything was just fine.
But
in her
if I understand correctly, and your opposing counsel can correct me if I'm wrong, my understanding from reading the record was that the employer made its decision based upon the restrictions as described by the physician, that the restrictions imposed would make her unsuitable, make this position that she's in unsuitable for permanent continued employment. Am I correct about that?
Well, you're correct that that's Beck's argument. I don't think the record shows that. There's no opinion from Ms. Kahn's doctor, Dr. Botker, specifically prohibiting her from working on the machines. That's something that's just kind of evolved during the course of this case, as I understand.
I don't mean specifically saying she can't work on the machines, but the doctor specifically indicated restrictions that the employer said would prohibit the performance of the permanent full-time position, any permanent full-time position, on an ongoing basis. I thought that's the way the record read. Correct me if I'm wrong.
With all due respect, I don't think that's what the record here says, because Ms. Khan was working full-time at her position, which was characterized as an extra position on the tables, the day she was fired. And that was within her permanent restrictions that the doctor had given as of March 7th, 2016, when he issued his MMI and the 3% permanent partial disability rating. So she continued to work in that position basically from January to June without problems. And so here we get to the last day when she's fired, and BIC says, we can't accommodate your permanent restrictions. And this did not come up.
Was that a were her duties in that position sustainable? I remember seeing something in the record that suggested that she would have to, they'd have to modify the position in such a way that would require other employees to do more repetitive work because she would not be able to. I thought that was what I saw in the record, but help me out if I'm wrong.
Your Honor, I think BIC made an argument to the effect that if Ms. Khan's job functions were accommodated to where she could rotate into work some of the machines gradually, but not all of them, that it could affect the rotation and the ergonomics of some of the other full-time employees in that department.
But you're saying that wasn't for the position that she was in at the time she was terminated. That was for a different position.
That's right.
Okay.
And again, the position of miscellaneous assembly operator was really in title only, not by her essential functions, and we touched on that in the brief, and I see my time is up at this point.
Thank you, Counsel. You're welcome. Counsel for response, you may approach.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jeff Stemmerick, and I represent the respondent, BIC Graphic, in this case. So for more than 2 years following a workplace injury, BIC Graphic did its utmost to help Tammy Khan return from her workplace injury. Ultimately, Khan's doctor gave her permanent work restrictions that could not reasonably be accommodated by BIC Graphic.
Can you respond to the last argument that maybe they couldn't accommodate with a different position, but the position that she was in at the time of the termination was one that she had been serving for quite some time, and she says she can continue to serve, and that would not violate the restrictions imposed by the physician.
Yes, Your Honor, I'll have to maybe back up and give a little broader explanation about this area first. So Khan worked in an area called miscellaneous assembly, and contrary to what's in the papers and what we heard just now, during your deposition, Khan had no trouble identifying her job as being a miscellaneous assembly operator, which is a machine operator position. And that's in accord with the testimony of every single BIC Graphic employee that testified. So there simply is no dispute that she was a miscellaneous assembly operator. The position that Mr. Fiebiger was referring to is this sort of table work, which is a very small aspect of the miscellaneous operator position. So the area has four primary operations, which consists of seven machines, and that's because one of the operations involves three machines in sequence. So really, it's a series of four major machine-driven operations. And then there's this miscellaneous assembly area table where they do rubber banding product, a variety of over 200 kind of hand-type tasks that can't be done with the machines, and as well as a handful of tabletop tools that are used less frequently. So the only work she could do with this restriction on repetitive elevation of the right arm, and that's the restriction we're talking about. We sort of shorten it to repetitive motion, but in reality, the doctor said what she can't do is lift her right arm on more than a rare to occasional basis. So this repetitive table work would have been within her restrictions. So that duty, that job, she was placed there solely because she couldn't do the rest of the position. So while she's recovering, but Graphic didn't want to terminate her, I wanted to give her the full opportunity to recover from this injury. And so it placed her working solely on the tables because that was the only work she could do in the area within her restriction. So it's a light-duty position created specifically for her to enable her to continue to heal. And once she did reach MMI, it undertook about 4 months of effort to come up with an accommodation between March and June of 2016. That would allow her to then have that full-time position. But that apart from the law that you don't have to convert a light-duty position into a permanent position as accommodation, is also the fact that even if they'd done that, Tammy Kahn wouldn't have been able to work there full-time. But Graphic is a cyclical plant. I mean, they make calendars. So starting in towards the end of the second quarter, October, November, December, their workload picks up significantly. They staff up with about 200 to 300 seasonal employees, and then all those employees go away over when the new year comes around. People aren't buying calendars anymore. So during that busy period, miscellaneous assembly operators, the five full-time operators of which Tammy Kahn was one, they work essentially full-time on the machines. The temporary employees handle the tabletop tools, the packing coming off of the machines, which is normally the operator's job.
So you're saying the tabling position that she had was a seasonal?
Correct, as well as the tables. Yeah, she wouldn't have been able to do that full-time January through. The first half of the year at all, there just simply wouldn't be. She'd be twiddling her thumbs most of the day, probably home on layoff more often than
working. Was she offered a seasonal position? I know that's not what is contended here, but was that ever one of the accommodations or suggestions that she'd pursue or be allowed to work in?
I don't believe that she was ever specifically offered a seasonal position. She was terminated, and she reached MMI in March and was terminated in June, so there wouldn't have been the seasonal workers don't typically start coming on until late September, early October. But no, she was never offered a seasonal position. There's nothing in the record to that effect. But even then, I mean, if she'd only been able to do the tables, she still wouldn't have been able to do a lot of the other operations in that area or any of the others that seasonal employees would have been required to do, lifting, et cetera.
Were there any other accommodations that were sought by her that would, within the restrictions, that would have been available for her?
There were not. In fact, Tammy Kahn testified that she never asked for any specific type of accommodation, and she also testified repeatedly that there were no accommodations available that would allow her to do the miscellaneous assembly operator position within that restriction on lifting the right arm. So she testified that there was not. A number of VIC employees testified that there was not, and part of that is, so these machines, the main task of the machine is loading and unloading the machine, which occurs at roughly shoulder or chest height. So the job requires hundreds of thousands of times a day lifting your arms to load these machines. And there's just no way around that aspect of it. I mean, she has to be able to lift that right arm hundreds to thousands of times a day to be able to operate really most of these machines, or at least half of them. So that's really the problem. That's why there's no accommodation that can get around it. It's just you have to be able to lift your right arm to load a machine, and you have to be able to do it a lot. And her doctor said she can only do that rarely or infrequently.
Can you address the argument that the evidence shows that as to major life activities, she offered testimony that she is unable to vacuum or to reach into her cupboard?
Yeah, so the testimony was that those tasks at the time she had her functional capacity evaluation gave her some discomfort. She didn't testify that she couldn't do any of them. It's just that they caused her some pain. She wasn't restricted from doing them. Those kind of motions were fine within her restrictions. I mean, obviously, she couldn't lift the arm on more to a rare or occasional basis, but, you don't load your cupboard hundreds of thousands of times a day. So the testimony was that it caused her pain, not that she couldn't do it. In fact, more importantly, she testified that the shoulder injury didn't materially limit any major activities, and it didn't prevent her from doing anything she wanted to do. So when I asked her that point blank, what can't you do with the injury that you want to do, she said nothing. So that it's undisputed, in fact, that there was nothing beyond being a miscellaneous assembly operator that she couldn't do with the injury. There was no other limitation in anything she wanted to do.
Well, she was asked the question, what can't you do? She wasn't asked the question, what are you limited in doing, right?
Well, was there anything? Yes, that's true. That she was. The question was, is there anything you want to do that you can't? And she said no to that.
Right. So is it possible then that one might read her testimony as saying that it's true that I can vacuum and I can reach into the cupboards, but the injury that I have materially limits my ability to do those things?
Yeah, I don't think that's a fair reading of the record, just because I don't think having a little discomfort in any task is a material limitation. Otherwise, I mean, we're all materially limited to a great extent. And frankly, it was her burden. I mean, if she had some material limitation on a major life activity, it was her burden to submit that evidence on summary judgment to create an issue of fact. And you don't get there with, I have a little bit of discomfort vacuuming and putting dishes away.
Do you recall her exact language? Did she say a little discomfort What exactly did she say in describing the pain that she experienced vacuuming and reaching into the cupboard?
You know, as we stand here today, I don't know that I could quote it. And given that it's in the deposition word for word, I think I'd rather have you look it up then than say something here that it would just be the best of my recollection, if that's all right, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Mr. Stemmerich, what be your answer to the definition of disabled person under the Human Rights Act in terms of this condition?
I'm sorry.
Do you agree she's disabled under the Human Rights Act, or do you disagree? And if you disagree, what's the main factual or legal argument you have that she would not be disabled under that act?
Yeah, so I disagree that she's disabled, and my main factual point is going to be, again, her own testimony in that regard. So to be disabled, you have to have an impairment that materially limits a major life activity. And here she testified point blank that she didn't have an impairment that materially limits a major life activity, and further that there wasn't anything that she wanted to do that she couldn't as a result of the injury. So under those circumstances, I would say that is not a material limitation on a major life activity, and that she doesn't meet that basic threshold question of even being a disabled person in the first place. And even if she was a disabled person, she doesn't meet the definition of being a qualified disabled person, right, which is somebody that can perform the essential functions of their job with or without an accommodation. So Khan testified that she was a miscellaneous assembly operator. The essential functions of that job included being able to run all of the machines. When asked which machine she was referring to, she named every single machine in the area by name, so there's no dispute that that's an essential function of the job she held. Then she repeatedly testified that there were no accommodations that would allow her to operate those machines. She couldn't do it within her doctor's restrictions. She had personally believed she could do the job by pushing through the pain and ignoring the physician's restrictions. But the law in this area is that once a doctor issues those restrictions, the employer is allowed to look at those, and they govern over any subjective belief. So with those three things, those three admissions in her own testimony, those repeated admissions demonstrate that even if she were disabled, she's certainly not a qualified disabled person, as that term is used.
So your position is that it's not a fact dispute between the testimony of Ms. Khan and the testimony of her physician as to whether she experienced this pain in a way that prevented her from serving in the position?
Yeah, that's correct, Your Honor. If you look at cases like Alexander versus the Northland Inn and Denson versus Steak and Shake, those cases squarely stand for the proposition that the employer is allowed to look to and can rely upon what the physician says. And if the law, frankly, is that although that may be a fact dispute sort of in a metaphysical sense for the purposes of the MHRA, the law is that you can't take the employee's subjective view. Because we have this happen all the time where a doctor says, and like say in this case, you know, you can't lift your right arm in Alexander versus the Northland Inn, and the doctor said she can't vacuum. No vacuuming was a permanent restriction. And you know, the employee says, oh, but I can vacuum. Now that puts the employer in a very bad spot because obviously they can't let her vacuum because she's going to get injured again and they're going to have more claims, et cetera. So the law is that once the physician says no vacuuming, you can't create an issue of fact on whether she could vacuum simply with her own subjective belief. It's the same principle here. Once the doctor says you can't lift that arm, that right arm, on more than a rare to occasional basis, and Khan admits that she cannot do this job without violating that restriction by lifting the arm on more rare than occasional basis, that's the end of the matter factually, as a matter of law, so to speak.
Mr. Stemmerich, could you comment a bit on the timing of the MMI and the discharge?
Yes, certainly, Your Honor.
Purely coincidental of that timing, and you understand the argument of the appellant?
Yes, yeah, so it is coincidental. I mean, it's just she reached MMI in March. They're working through accommodations. That process ran its course in June. It happened to be coincidental that the email he refers to didn't tie the end of the termination to the end of benefits, and even if it did, that's not what the statute prohibits. So Your Honors are right. It was Judge Ross was asking who started the workers' compensation claim. Tammy Khan testified that she got injured, and Bit Graphic automatically enrolled her in workers' comp. So Bit Graphic sought benefits on her behalf. That occurred 28 months before Khan was terminated. Over that 28 months, Khan had two surgeries, which was followed by 6 months off each time, all of which was paid for by workers' compensation, the time off, the surgeries, the follow-up physical therapy, all of it. And then she was terminated only 28 months later. In fact, she didn't realize there was a workers' compensation retaliation claim in this complaint because when I asked her why she thought she'd been terminated for seeking workers' compensation at her deposition. She said, where is that at? Basically asking me, where in the papers does it say? That's what I'm claiming. Just to wrap up, Section 176.82, Subdivision 1, does only prevent account for retaliation for seeking benefits. District Court was correct in rejecting Kahn's claim that termination in proximity to the end of the statutorily set completion of benefits could somehow support a retaliation claim. And that's all that I would like to cover today, unless the Court has further questions.
Very well. Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just ask that the Court affirm summary judgment. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for Appellant, you may rebut if you wish.
I'd like to touch on some of the issues raised during the respondent's argument. I think the record is clear to show that Ms. Kahn could have continued to work in her job as an extra person on the tables where she was working full-time on the date she was terminated. Her supervisor, Kim Janke, testified that she could have continued to work full-time on the tables. The area director, Jeff Heiling, who supervised Kim Janke, said he was unaware of any reason why Ms. Kahn's position couldn't be modified so she could continue working. And I think that's really the crux of that issue, is that there really was no evidence or reason presented as to why she couldn't continue doing what she was doing. There was work to be done. They were bringing in temporary employees, and she was working full time. It's our position that that raises a fact issue as to the ability to provide a reasonable accommodation.
Counsel, isn't it undisputed that the tables work was seasonal? In other words, there were no full-time tables workers that didn't rotate onto the machines.
I think that's a issue in dispute, Your Honor. I think what BIC did, as I understand it, is they brought in more temporary workers as the business got busier during the fall season prior to sending out calendars. But it was a 12-month operation. They didn't close down, and there was somebody working on the tables year-round, as I understand.
But wasn't there evidence that those people rotated onto the machines from the tables? In other words, there was not a full-time tables position year-round.
I think that's right, as I understand it. But I think under the MHRA, providing job modification is a reasonable accommodation.
The record's pretty clear on that, I thought, that if this were so, and that was the issue I was raising before, if the modification was that your client got to serve in that position on a full-time basis and others didn't, that would mean that they would not get relief from the repetitive activities they had to engage in working the machines.
My understanding is that the employees rotated every 2 hours on the machines during a work day, and then in addition to that, they would rotate, say, every week or every 2 weeks between the machines. So there was ongoing
right.
rotation.
Right. So if your client, if during, I'm trying to get a sense of what the record would say about those periods where it wasn't, where you didn't have the intensity and the demand for workers during the downturn, and you didn't have the seasonal workers, whether or not a person could serve full time working the tables without infringing on the ability of the employer to rotate others out of the repetitive motion activities.
I think they could have, because the table duties themselves were repetitive.
And when you say you think they could have, is there evidence to support that thought?
I think the fact that they brought in temporary workers who would do that, they would work some only on the tables. Some would work on a few machines and not rotate to all the machines. So they were doing that, but they just said they couldn't do that for Ms. Kahn.
They couldn't do that for Ms. Kahn. Do what for Ms. Kahn? Is there, going back to Judge Kalatowski's question, is there any evidence that there was ever any person assigned full-time to the tables who didn't have the repetitive activity obligations in working the machines?
Not that I'm aware of.
Is there any evidence that it would be reasonable for the employer to create a position where an employee would work full-time on the tables and could work full-time on the tables without affecting the employer's ability to relieve other employees from the repetitive motion activities?
Yes, I think it would have been here specifically because Ms. Kahn did that for 5 months and there was no impact on any of the other rotations. There's no evidence of that, that there were ergonomic problems or people had trouble rotating.
This is during, the argument is this is during the high season. This is the season where the demand for workers is highest and seasonal workers were being employed. But what does the record say about during those, that circumstance that we're talking about during the periods where the demand for employees is not so high?
Again, I think this case shows that it was workable because she worked from January to June, which wasn't the heavy season. The heavy season was in the fall, and she worked basically from the winter until the spring, maybe the beginning of summer, which was the downtime, so to speak, or lower intensity work. So it was workable, and her QRC made efforts to try to ask about additional modifications with their doctor that were rebuffed and weren't even responded to, as the record will show. I see my time has run out, and I would ask that the court reverse and remand the case to the district court.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel and for the briefing as well. We appreciate that, and you have a good day. We'll have the matter under advisement.